welcome to Joyce Barry and Friends, with stimulating talk, news you can use, and wonderful ways to get ahead, have fun, and make more money. We always have hot guests and cool topics. We even have cool guests and hot topics. Today, our very, very cool guest is Peter Ford, son of very famous actor Glenn Ford, who is here to talk to you about his new book called Glenn Ford, A Life. Also on deck, I have invited John Bell, a regular on our show, to be my co-host today, and both of us will be interviewing Peter. So first, I want to start off by wishing all you dads out there a happy Father's Day. Peter, I'll go over to you first. What's it like for you to be a father?
Well, I love being a father, and I wanted to be one very much since I was a small, you know, young child. And it's a very serious obligation. It has very serious consequences if you don't do it right, or it can. And, you know, I devote myself to my children, and I hope they appreciate it one day, but I guess time will tell.
And, John, you're a dad as well. What's it like for you?
Well, Joyce, fatherhood is one of those things that you can't experience in any other way except to have children, so that you can be successful in business, you can be successful, you know, you can have friends, you can make lots of money, but you can't get the experience of fatherhood unless you actually have children. And I'll tell you, it was perhaps the most challenging and rewarding experience of my life. It's something that I am so glad I got an opportunity to experience. I think that it's been probably one of the few things that shaped my life more than perhaps my parents did.
Thank you both for that. And what better day than to have Peter Ford than to usher in Father's Day this weekend. So let me tell you who is Peter Ford. Peter Ford is the son of Glenn Ford and Eleanor Powell. Peter Ford had the good fortune of being the only child of two of Hollywood's most renowned stars, Eleanor Powell, one of MGM's greatest musical stars, and Glenn Ford, Hollywood's number one box office star of 1958. At the age of 33, Eleanor Powell gave up her career to take on the new and, according to her, most important role of wife and mother, giving up her career to be married to a little-known actor by the name of Glenn Ford, had studio moguls and fans in an uproar. It wasn't until 3 years after their marriage in 46 that the public knew who Glenn Ford really was. It was that year that Gilda was released, starring Glenn and Rita Hayworth. Glenn Ford became a star overnight. Peter recalls, because of my mother's earlier Broadway career, I met many luminaries of the stage. Eddie Cantor and Sophie Tucker were regular visitors, as was Al Jolson, who my mother once briefly dated. One clear memory is of going to Pick Fair as a child, the social watering hole in those days, and sitting on Mary Pickford's knee as she told me stories of the old days. Peter graduated from Chadwick High in Virtus, California in 1962. He received an Associate's of Arts degree from Santa Monica College in 66 while pursuing a career as an actor and singer. Under contract to Capitol Records, Peter was mentored by the incomparable Nat King Cole. I mean, that is pretty amazing as well. It is almost a given that the only child of two people in the business would try his hand at the same profession. Peter did, working in nearly two dozen film projects as an actor and dialogue director. The first film, which father and son worked in together, was Gilda in 46, where director Charles Vider used Peter's photo to represent Johnny Farrell, which was Glenn's role in the film as a child, and later The Americano in 54. Peter's first speaking role was in The Gazebo in 59, one of Glenn's favorite comedies, co-starring Debbie Reynolds. He also appeared in Pocketful of Miracles, Dear Heart, Advance to the Rear, Fate is the Hunter, and The Randers. Still at Fox in 72, Peter was cast as a series regular as well as dialogue director of his father's new TV series, Cades County. Peter appeared as the forensic lab deputy Peter Odom in nearly every one of the 24 episodes. Today, Peter collects movie memorabilia from Hollywood's Golden Age and maintains the Glenn Ford and Eleanor Powell Library and Archives. As a writer, he published numerous articles And today he is the author of Glenn Ford, A Life, a definitive biography of his father, published by the University of Wisconsin Press, and that is what we will focus on today. And folks, you can check that out by going to glennfordbio.com. So without further ado, I bring to you Peter Ford. Peter, what had you decide to write the book on your dad, and how long ago did you start it?
Well, what prompted me to do it is Anne Francis, our dear family friend who most out there would probably know from her TV days as Honey West, but she also played my father's wife in the film Blackboard Jungle, and Anne used to come over quite often, and she prodded me enough to get me going, and so I started. And I started it about 2 years before my father passed. My dad died in 2006, so I started the slow process of when he was alive, and we worked together on it for a few years, and then he became ill, you know, quite ill. He died at age 90. So, but it was fun. I have every one of his diaries since 1934. He kept a diary of his life. I mean, not every day is in there, but almost every day. And so it was an abundance of material that I had, and no book had ever been written about him, not even a films of book. And he was a significant actor in the pantheon of acting stars, and I thought, you know, it needs to be written. Plus, there was a story to be told about my mother, and who was also a great star in her day in the 30s at MGM, and me. And it's kind of three books into one. It's kind of his story, my mother's story, and our story as a family. So, and it was not all peaches and cream. There was some pain in there. He was a very complex guy, and he had some dark sides to his life, and I just thought it would be an interesting read. And you know, if you go to Amazon.com, where the book is for sale, I would just encourage people to read the reviews. I mean, so far they've been very encouraging, but I think the people who have left reviews, you know, kind of got it, and they reflect the what I was trying to do. And I'm real happy that I was able to write something that seems to resonate with people.
Was your father alive when you started writing the book? And if so, did you have conversations with him about it?
Yeah, well, that's what I just said. I did, yeah.
Now, you said he had taken the notes and all of that, but I don't know how much of it you shared with him. Did he really know where it was going,
well,
and was he okay with it?
Oh, yeah. Well, it took me 7 years, so obviously he passed it in the second year of the seventh, so I had 5 years without him to do it. But and it was on and off. I'm not saying I sat there like you know, Voltaire writing with my my oil lamp and my quill. But I got the gist of it, and he knew that, you know, speaking of Father's Day, Joyce and John, I mean, he was a great actor, but he was not necessarily a good father, and maybe we'll get into that. I came to terms with that. You know, he was a tremendous actor who gave everything to his craft, and when I say everything, it was everything. And when he came home after 12 hours of work, he really didn't have the time, or didn't at least take the time, which is important that fathers must do if we're going to be on that theme, to be a buddy to his son. And quite frankly, in some of his picadillos, he was not necessarily the best husband either. But my mother was long-suffering, and we were a unit, and so we weathered all of that, and that's what the book is about. It's a cautionary tale, really, Joyce. You know, it's again, it's not a Daddy Dearest book, but I learned a lot from my dad, and sadly, in most cases, it was what not to do. And you know, I honor him as a great actor, but I learned that you know, to be a good father, you have to work at it. It's not something that, you know, and it's hard work. And you know, when your little ones are born to you, for a mother or a dad, you know, there's no school that tells you how to do it. You can't read a book and it'll say, well, okay, this is what you do. I mean, you've got to kind of figure it out. And it's as I said earlier, it's an obligation that is very serious, and the consequences for those poor kids who have gone bad in their lives when they get older, it's major, and there's a reason why we have crime and we have people who are suffering, and I think it boils all down to basically how they were raised and their value system, and if you don't have that or you don't have encouragement, it can be devastating.
Peter, John Bell here.
Yes, sir.
The thing that intrigued me most about you writing this book, and in a sense the children of famous people writing books in general about their parents, is that how did you acquire the necessary distance? You just mentioned that your father wasn't the best father in the world, maybe one of the best actors in the world, at least I thought that.
Right.
But how did you acquire enough distance to be able to look at him objectively in some ways when the subject matter was so subjective?
Well, yeah, it was. And as I said, John, I didn't say this, but when I was 16, he didn't show up for my high school graduation. And
mm-hmm.
It was at that, and he wasn't there for me many times. I'm not saying it was all negative, but he was, you know, again, he was off in Europe making films. And he just, you know, he did not recognize his obligation to me, is that's how I'd say it. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, is that there's others like that, you know. There's Henry Fonda. I mean, I could go through a whole list. You know, Bill Holder.
Well,
there are
a lot of fathers who are not quite as busy as yours was, who had the same problem. By the way.
Yeah. No, I agree. I agree. And as I say, that's a cautionary tale. And
exactly.
So you just. But I finally, when I was 16, we never. I don't want to. Please, I'm not trying to take people to the couch with me. With, you know, this is not. You know, we're not going to the psychiatrist together. But it's important to know that I came to, as opposed to many of my peers, and I can talk about how many of my offspring of movie stars have either killed themselves or, you know, I don't want to be too depressing because Joyce's show is very uplifting, but I'm not going to have that buddy that I wanted. I'm not going to have the father.
Exactly.
You know, and so what am I going to do about it? Am I going to be, you know, like Paul Newman's son and like, you know, Cary Grant's son, Gregory Peck's son and Diane Linkletter, Art's daughter, and do, you know, do something horrible, or am I going to just take the glass half full point of view, which I think Joyce would agree with? And I said, you know, I'm going to make, as you say, I'm going to make lemonade out of lemons, and I'm going to celebrate what I can. And I became a big fan, and he is a great actor. And so I said, well, you know, get over it, Peter. You're not going to have a buddy. You're not going to have a dad who wraps you in his arms and loves you and tells you that thing, you know, which he never did till the day passed. So I just took what I could get, and I made the best of it. And I don't know. It was a very mature decision looking back at it now. But I did that. But I'm like Joyce, and I'm sure like you, John. I'm a forward-looking person. I don't dwell
right.
on misery. If I can't – fix something or be in control of having that consequence, I just don't deal with it because that's
exactly.
There's nothing you can do about some things, and you just, you know, it's just, you just have to move ahead.
Exactly.
Yeah, the lesson,
you know what?
That I reflect on when it's nothing you can do, you just say to yourself, it is what it is, and then just make the best of it and get the lesson from it so you can move forward.
That's exactly right.
They have said that if you can't change what's going on, change the way you think about it, because that's going to help you decide on what kind of a life you're going to have. But you know what? I'd like to get back to your father again. There are two sides to, there are probably many sides to this man's personality. But I have always wondered why I have never seen Glenn Ford in, I've seen him in a couple of movies that weren't great, but I've never seen Glenn Ford play a role where he was not great. And I don't understand why he didn't get more, I guess, approval, more accolades from his community, from the public, for being such an incredibly good actor. When you look at the wide range of acting, from The Big Heat to Tea House of the August Moon to Blackboard Jungle, I mean, he had such scope and such, he had a kind of panorama of skills that I don't think any actor today has.
Oh, I agree with you 100%. You know, he was an incredible actor, and I think so underrated. And of course, you know, as a culture today, our young people have kind of not only forgotten about Glenn Ford, but about all the other lessons of history.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm not, you know, it's not just dad, but, you know, you talked to somebody today. I mean, some of the youngest ones, they don't even know who the Beatles are anymore. So I don't know what's happened to us as a culture. But no, the reason I have pondered this, John, for years, and I believe it is the fact that, well, first of all, he was a contract player, and he was under contract from 1940 to 54, 2 7-year contracts at Columbia, and then he went over to MGM, and he was with them, you know, for most of his career to the, you know,
yes.
Bills. And he did some independence, but he was not able to pick his films necessarily, and Harry Cohen at Columbia put him in some turkeys, you know. But again, that doesn't mean he was a bad actor, and I agree with you, he never gave a bad performance, but. And the other problem is that Harry Cohen over at Columbia, for those who study film or you know, interested in it, he mm-hmm. was like the, I mean, you had MGM and then you had 20th Century Fox and Paramount. Harry Cohen was kind of a, you know, he didn't have the money to spend. I think Frank Capra was one of the few major directors he had. So the director's dad, first of all, the films weren't great because Harry wouldn't pay the money. And then, you know, he didn't hire the top directors. I mean, Dad never worked with Billy Wilder or Hitchcock or, you know, there's a whole litany of them,
mm-hmm.
Howard Hawks. And so he got some of the, you know, the second-line directors because that's what Harry would employ. And finally, when he got over to MGM in 1954, he did Interrupted Melody first with Eleanor Parker, and she was nominated for an Academy Award for that. And then, of course, Blackboard Jungle, which is a very, very significant film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they put the resources. Dori Sherry had taken over there for Louis B. Mayer, and they put the resources behind him, and that is when, you know, he got noticed. All of the reviews I have from the films he did in the 50s, you know, these are the, you know, just well, the critics, and every one of them said, he's going to win an Academy Award. You know, he's not just be nominated. He's going to win the Academy Award. And every year, he not only didn't win, but he never got nominated. So,
mm-hmm.
But again, he never complained. I asked him about that. He said, you know, Pete, well, he kind of took my attitude, you know, about life. He just said, there's nothing I can do about it. And there wasn't. But I think, you know, the long and the short of it, John, he was not in the top pictures. Of some of the pictures he was promised, like Here From Here to Eternity by Harry, which he did make, you know, he never got in. And then for some other circumstances, which are in the book, he missed the opportunity to be in some films, like Born Yesterday. He was supposed to have done
mm-hmm.
that part that Bill Holden did. But
wasn't he supposed to be in a movie that John Wayne eventually did because
he was going
to
play
Hondo.
Was
committed to another.
Yeah,
yes, exactly.
Yeah, John wanted him to be in Hondo, and my dad had done Plunder of the Sun for John and Bob Fellows down in Mexico with Patricia Medina, and they really liked the work he did, and that's a little film that's kind of a sleeper. It's a very good film that
mm-hmm.
he made for John. And John said, "Oh God, Glenn, you're so good. I'm going to put you in Hondo." And then he, you know, so there's another one he missed, you know. So there were missed opportunities. But I think the short answer, which I have not given you, I'm sorry, is that he had some not the best directors, and he had a his boss was not buying the best scripts.
Gotcha.
Yeah, that's my
thing. I'm going to ask you, Peter. Were you closer with your mother?
Oh God, she was a blessing. My mother was, without my mother, Joyce, I would not be above ground and breathing, I promise you. She was just the most wonderful, wonderful woman. And Fred Astaire told me himself, she is the best dancer on film, including himself. So, I mean, when you hear that from Fred Astaire, I mean, that's a pretty good endorsement. But not only was she just a great actress and a great dancer, well, not actress necessarily, but a great dancer, but she was, as a person, even more stellar than that. She was just the most wonderful woman, and it was because of her that I basically survived. Peter,
is there any truth to the, I don't know whether it's a rumor or not, that your mother, in a sense, gave up her career when she married Glenn?
Yes. Yeah, she did, and that therein was the problem. Because, and again, it's in the book, so I don't mind talking
mm-hmm.
about it. But we could be on this for a couple hours, and we don't have the time. Long and the short of it, John, is this: She was a giant star at MGM, and she retired because she desperately wanted to be a mother and a wife. Unfortunately, my father and she, my mother never went beyond the eighth grade. I mean, and I'm not saying you need a higher education or even high school to be successful, but they both were basically naive people, and I don't mean that in any pejorative sense. They were not experienced. So when I was born, and the circumstances were, my dad was in the Marines, and they really he came out in December '44. I was born in February of '45. So they had and she was pregnant during the time he was in the Marines, because they had this little house they rented near Camp Pendleton down in Southern California and in La Jolla, California, and that's where I was conceived on his birthday, May 1st, 1944. And in fact, I have that in the diary, by the way, John. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so here I pop out, and my mother, not knowing what she should do, she became, the focused dancing star of MGM, where she would rehearse to her feet actually bled. She became she wanted to be the best mother in the world, and unfortunately, she did that to the exclusion of my dad. And mm-hmm. therein began the problem. And the more she doted on me and ignored him, the more he was angry. And I became I was getting squeezed in the middle. And I'm, what do I know? I'm just this little thing. And it became, just this horrible situation. And it never did get cured, unfortunately. So, and then he drifted off into Rita Hayworth's arms and a few dozen others, as you can read in the book, and that, of course, that fueled the fire, and it was a disaster. But again, it's just what it was, and I don't know, and it can't be any different now. But I try to talk about all that and explore that, more than just kind of being feeling sorry for myself or our family. It's I don't know. I thought, I need to write about this. And to answer Joyce's question earlier, that's why I did it. I thought it was an interesting tale.
What was interesting about the book?
You can purchase the book at Amazon.com. You can go mm-hmm. to www.glennford, and Glenn has two N's, glennfordbio.com. You can find out more about Peter Ford by going to his website at peterford.com. Right now, I have to break away for a moment to find out a bit about our sponsor.
I wish I could lose weight.
I wish I could turn off my hunger switch.
I wish I could get rid of my love handles.
You know what I wish for? An energy boost.
If you'd like to lose weight, lose inches, curb your appetite, and boost your energy, then it's time to stop wishing. It's time to put diet magic into your life. That's right, diet magic. Diet magic is a simple little pill that works in so many powerful ways, like controlling cravings, melting unwanted inches, and improving your mood and energy. Diet magic is safe and works fast, with no jitters, no shakes, no adverse side effects, and no prescription required. Try a Diet Magic trial pack today by logging on to DietMagicWow.com. That's DietMagicWow.com. Diet Magic, the little pill with big results in appetite control, weight loss, and great energy. Order your Diet Magic trial pack right now online at DietMagicWow.com. That's DietMagicWow.com.
Diet Magic, wow!
I'm going to open up the lines. I have Mike Murphy on the line. Mike, were you as wowed by the book as I was? What would you like to say about Glenn Ford, Alive by Peter Ford?
I think it's a fantastic book. This wouldn't have happened to me if Peter hadn't invited me to his father's birthday party when he was 90 years old. And that's when I met Peter, and he'd been working on the book for 2 years. I have a beautiful copy of the book that's been autographed and inscribed by Peter and his wife both, and I'm very proud of it. And I just want to urge anyone that enjoyed Glenn's films, or even if they didn't enjoy his films, read this book. It is a very revealing book. It's a wonderful book. I heard a great comment down at the Western Music Festival a couple of weeks ago in Mississippi. Boyd Majors, who takes care of that, runs that thing, said it's probably the best bio to come out of Hollywood in a long time, and I think that's, I don't think you can get much better than that.
I love the book as well. I love the pictures in the book. I really like those. There's lots and lots of pictures. Because I remember, you know, Glenn Ford's movie so well. I was very taken with him. I want to cite this quote, which I think you get more clarification in the book as well. This quote, of course, by Glenn Ford. We are all three people. The person we think we are, the person the world thinks we are, and the person we really are. What an appropriate quote, Peter. And I think you get into that a lot in your own way in the book. The person we thought he was, the hero on the screen, and who he really was is your father as a human being. What would you like to say about that?
Well, no, that's exactly right. I mean, he gave that quote in 1949. That's exactly the case. He, you know, and I think, you know, and for people who are famous, not, you know, necessarily, you know, the average person, the world doesn't have an opinion of, you know, my dentist maybe, but for somebody who's famous, that's very telling, and I agree with you, and I think he knew, you know, he knew who he was and who he wasn't, and I mean, if anything, you know, because, and again, I respect him greatly as an actor, you know, so I'm not, it's not, as I said earlier, I'm not dishing him, but I think that it just speaks, you know, to the fact that he was such a great actor, because nobody knew there was anything other than, you know, this Jimmy Stewart-esque kind of guy. But in truth, he was you know, he had a very dark part of him, and he had a libido like Errol Flynn, you know, and women loved him, and he loved women. And in fact, his libido, Joyce, was functioning until the day he died. I mean, he just loved women, and they loved him, and he had that kind of a magnetism on screen. You know, he had that little smile of his, and women just went crazy over him. So,
and he was stunning.
Oh, yeah.
And charming. He had everything that every woman is sitting there saying, "I wish I could be with him."
No, I agree. I agree with you. And that kind of, this is kind of a little joke. And Mike knows Linda, my wife. Now, I've been married 40 years to Linda Joyce, and she is my very best friend. And I know I've told this to people. They say that's not true. It's never. I said we have never had a bad word between us. We have never had a fight. I tell her I love her every day, and she is my best buddy. And we're going on to our 41st year this December, and I mean that quite sincerely. But I learned at the knee of the master what not to do. And I as far as being a husband and a father, I have learned my lesson, and if my 40 years of happy marriage is any reflection on my ability to do so, I think that is. But Mike will tell you, Linda will not let me out of her sight. I mean, I've been invited to these film festivals, and I'm going up to Seattle actually, right after the 4th of July to appear up on Bainbridge Island and up in Seattle at a couple of book events, and there Linda's letting me go. This is the first time, but she said, you know, the fruit doesn't fall far from the tree, and I'm not letting. I said, Linda, we've been married 40 years. Don't you trust me? So she said, I trust you, but it's the other ones I don't trust. So. It's really kind of a joke.
It's the women around you she doesn't trust. Peter, when you grew up, did your parents seem to have a good marriage, or were you aware then of the indiscretions on the part of your dad?
Very much aware. And I talk about that, you know, we every weekend, Joyce, I kind of felt early on, and again, this is not with my mom, just with the situation that we, our family, that I was sent from Central Casting to be playing the role of a son, because every weekend I have hundreds and hundreds of movie magazines. I do try and collect them on the family, but of all of us, you know, Ford Family Fun. I mean, there's just, I have all of these, and we would roll out on the weekends. The photographers would come to the house. We lived in a 22-room mansion in Beverly Hills. I had my own Olympic-sized swimming pool. I mean, you know, it was a life of at the time I didn't know, but
a life of privilege
in excess, absolutely, just, you know, really obscene, really, when you think about it. But what we would do, we would do the happy family deal on the weekend, and of course, you know, after the press left, we went back to our corners, and life went on. But it was the whole thing was really make believe, and I knew right away, and you know, it was that's why I wrote the book.
Well, the industry is all make-believe. Just one more question, John, and I'll turn it over to you. As a child, were you aware of the celebrity of your father? Like, did you appreciate who he was as an actor when you were growing up?
Not when I was younger, Joyce. I really had no idea. You know, when as you mentioned, when Eddie Cantor and, well, you know, Barbara Streisand, Brian Stanwyck would come to dinner, and Eddie G. Robinson and all these people, you know, I didn't know. They were just dad's, you know, he worked with these people, and they are just regular people. They just happen to be famous people, but they're, you know, they're, all of these people are no different than us. I mean, they just happen to be famous.
You, Peter, you sound like a regular person yourself. I had friends that met you at a book signing at the library, and everyone there, they just marvel that you were so down to earth, you were so real. They really enjoyed having that talk with you at the library.
I am. There's no pretense with me at all. I'm kind of a humble guy. Because, you know, who am I? I just happen to be, you know, born to these two people. I'm nobody. I'm just like everybody. I don't have any sense of, you know, elan about myself. But when I was younger, after a while, I figured out, you know, gee, my parents are sending autographed pictures to people, and, you know, that's kind of odd. Why would, you know? And of course, I figured it out. But my dad and mom divorced when I was 14, which of course that in itself was hugely traumatic. But I, you know, maybe age around 8 or 9 or 10, I figured out that, you know, that they were different. It was an interesting life, I'll tell you that, because I knew all of those people. I caddied golf with it was a friend of Clark Gable's who I knew, Marion Davies' husband, Captain Horace Brown, who she married after William Randolph Hearst died. But I was caddying for Horace Brown and who my dad knew from the Navy League, and Clark Gable would, you know, we'd be a foursome, or they would be a twosome, and I would caddy. So I met all of these people, and they were just in my life. I feel like I'm about 150, but it was a pleasure to see those people.
Peter, you have done an excellent job in the book of combining both what you call the dark side of your father's life with his professional side, which is incredible, the way you've woven in the comments made by many of the people he worked with, which kind of illustrate the fact that as a professional, at least, he was held in high regard by everybody who worked with him. There was practically no one in the Hollywood scene of those years who didn't think Glenn was one of the best actors around, one of the most professional people around, somebody who showed up and did his job every single time and did a great job. Weaving those two things together, I think, has been very, very important to see both sides, if not two of many sides of your father's life.
Yeah, no, I agree. I tried to, and I guess I was successful so far. I've not been, you know, they've not excoriated me anywhere. Of course, I haven't been reviewed anywhere. The problem, you know, John, is I'm with the University of Wisconsin Press, which is a small press, mm-hmm. a wonderful press, but they're kind of a boutique press more than Random House or, you know, HarperCollins, some of the big boys. That's why I'm having to do everything myself, you know, to try and get the book out.
To promote the book.
Yeah, I just
interested in knowing, what would your father think of today's movies? He was from a different period and a different kind of actor, and I have often wondered what he would think about watching some of the modern movies.
Well, I think probably not. He wouldn't think much of them, because even, mm-hmm. you know, he would watch them before he passed. We used to get what they call screeners, and people in the Academy would get that all of the studios would send the movies that would be hoping to be nominated and certainly mm-hmm. nominated. So we would get. Over 100 movies would come to the house, and I would put a few on for him, and the ones that were, you know, kind of more significant than others, and he was very critical. I mean, and not about the acting, but the gratuitous sex and the gratuitous violence and the fact that today, I don't know what's happened to our screenwriters, but the stories. I mean, if you if today, if you can take off your clothes and kill somebody at the same time, you know, you're a star.
Or drive a car really fast.
Right, right. You're a star. That's it. You know, that doesn't. But you look at a movie like Double Indemnity or White
Heat. Exactly.
Oh, my God. I mean, those film noirs especially. I love film noir. And my dad, you know.
The Big Heat.
Oh, The Big Heat. Yeah, it was a great, great film. But they have stories, and they have you know, there's character development. And plus, we were blessed in those days, John, with all of those great character actors who used to populate the films. There's not many of those. Of those actors today.
No.
I mean, you look at, like, my dad did a lot of films with Edgar Buchanan and you know, where are those people today? You don't see them. But you know, it's a different business now. It's money, it's sensation, you know, I'm not saying a movie like Avatar isn't an important film, but it's just there's not that personal interaction. There's no tension like there used to be, and so, you know, it's just a different
world.
Your
father didn't have the advantage of all the computer graphics either.
No.
It worked into a movie like Avatar.
Right.
He had to do it all pretty much on film. Did your father study acting, or was this a natural talent that he just developed from working?
Well, I think the answer is that he as a young child he always wanted to be an actor, and so. But he was born in Canada, actually. His given his birth name was Willem Ford, and it's Welsh, because there's Welsh lines in our family. And he and his dad and he was an only child, and my mother was an only child, and I'm an only child. So they came to California in 1922 when he was just a young lad, and he immediately, when he got to that was out here, it's called Lincoln Platoon School, it was called, but it's Lincoln Junior High now in Santa Monica. He started acting in little plays, and then he went to Santa Monica High School, and that is where he really developed his skills. And he joined seven different little theater groups, and it was through little theater and actually doing it that he learned his craft. And I have dozens and dozens of playbills and where he would, you know, play different parts. And it was in one of those plays that he got discovered by a talent scout from 20th Century Fox and a couple of missed opportunities, but eventually he got signed by Daryl Zanuck to do his first film in 1939, and called Heaven with a Bob Wire Fence. And that was really what started his career.
Another quote of his, which I thought was very interesting, he said it took him several years to learn how not to act.
Right.
And I thought that was significant. When you see a Glenn Ford movie, you don't see an actor.
No,
you see the character.
Yeah, you're right. You don't ever catch him acting. And a lot of actors, you do. And so, no, he was... But yeah, he was good from the start. But he, even as a little child, I think I mentioned in the book, at home when he was up in Canada, he'd throw the curtains, he'd hide behind the curtains, and he'd have his mom and dad sitting, you know, in chairs opposite him up in Canada, and he'd throw the curtains open and start reading the newspaper. So he was a ham, as they call it, from the beginning. But John, getting back to your other question, that might be part of the quote unquote problem. Is that he didn't care what he was in. You know, he never really, I can't say he did turn down a few things that Harry tried to put him in, but Harry Cohen, but he didn't care. He just wanted to act. And for him, it was just doing the work. And you know, toward the end of his life, he just kept going, and he did a lot of stuff that was not really too good, you know, at the end. But they paid him big money, and
why not?
Well, yeah, why not? He's got, you know, look, he did this thing called Casablanca Express. They flew him to Morocco. They stopped in Paris, I think, for, you know, like 3 days, first class, you know, the whole thing with a per diem. And they, at the end of the show, he worked 3 days. They paid him $100,000 in cash in a briefcase that he brought home. I mean, you know, it's kind of tempting, John.
I can imagine.
Yeah, but the movie itself was horrible. But, you know. Anyway, but, you know.
But the perks made it worthwhile.
Yeah, yeah.
I have to break away to my sponsor. I'll come right back to Peter Ford and my co-host today, John Bell.
Would you like to curb your appetite and lose weight? Would you believe there's a product that not only turns off your hunger switch, it also helps you lose weight, lose inches, and boost your energy? The product is Diet Magic, and it works like magic. Diet Magic is a simple little pill that works in so many powerful ways. Diet Magic helps control cravings, melts unwanted inches off your body, and improves your mood and energy. Diet Magic is safe and works fast with no jitters, no shakes, no adverse side effects, and no prescription required. Try a Diet Magic trial pack today and experience this phenomenal product for yourself by logging on to DietMagicWow.com. That's DietMagicWow.com. Diet Magic, the little pill with big results in appetite control, weight loss, and great energy. Order your Diet Magic trial pack right now online at DietMagicWow.com. That's DietMagicWow.com.
Diet Magic. Wow.
Another quote by your dad was, "People laugh when I say I'm not an actor, but I'm not. I play myself. Americans playing Shakespeare are really ridiculous." And it did seem like it was always himself. We just talked about that a few moments ago, that he was so real and so natural.
Yeah, no, he did. He just, you know, in fact, there's another quote that they said, you know, they always tell me to hurry up, I guess. And he said, "I only have one speed, and that's slow." So that's kind of the way he was. He was just he knew what he wanted to do. I mean, he was experienced enough to not be intimidated by some directors, and he knew what he wanted to do, and he did it his way.
Yeah,
Peter,
I did it.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Peter, what I was going to say is that. You can tell a lot about a person from the kind of work that they appreciate of their own. I love The Big Heat. I love 310 to Yuma, Tea House of the August Moon, which showed the range of your father. But what was his favorite movie? Which one did he do that he thought was his best work?
Well, of course, anything with Rita Hayworth, you know, for obvious reasons.
From Gilda on.
Yeah, from Gilda on. They made five together. But although, I tell you the truth, the reason he didn't take, which was offered to him, Born Yesterday with Brad Crawford and I think Judy Holliday was in
Judy
that.
Holliday, yes.
Yeah, but the reason he didn't take that is because in 1948 he was in this film called Loves of Carmen with Rita that they shot up in Lone Pine, California, and he played Don Juan and she was Carmen, and he had this curly hair and these extremely tight pants on, like a, you know, almost like the, like these like, you know, tights like you would see in Robin Hood,
like a ballet dancer.
Yeah, and in fact, in his diaries, he's complaining about how much weight he had to lose to look good in these things. But anyway, he did not like himself in that movie. In fact, he said that he would, if he could, he'd buy every print and burn them, and, you know, so it wouldn't exist. But anyway, the problem was in that movie for him is that he felt that Rita dominated him. He was not the, you know, he was not the macho male that he always liked to play, and which he was. But so when Born Yesterday was offered to him and he read the script, he felt that the part, Bill's part, William Holden's part, was emasculating to, you know, would have been emasculated, and he didn't want to take the chance with that again.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Bill and Dad, I think, you know, if you had to put two actors together whose careers kind of paralleled each other, it would be the two of them, and they were very, very good friends. But anyway, he turned that down because he felt that, you know, here we go again with another Loves of Carmen. And of course, Bill Holden did a great job in that film, but that would have been another real good straw in his hat, you know, feather in his hat, if he could have done that film. But you know, hey, it's very interesting. I can't tell you how many films I'm sure this with every actor, how many films are offered and missed opportunities and all of that stuff. It's very interesting, anyway, that's.
You can buy this book at Amazon.com. You really want to have your copy of it. You can go to GlennFordBio.com as well. And to find out more about Peter, that would be PeterFord.com. It really is a fascinating story. you know, growing up, and I always loved the movies. I didn't have people like that coming over to my home, the kind of guests you had. It's just, like, amazing that when you're born into it, how it's so much a part of your life. You talked about, you know, the famous people that were there. James Mason was one of your babysitters. Any other famous people take care of you?
Oh, well, not take care of me necessarily, but Johnny Weissmuller, who my mom met when she was first starting back in the 20s, Johnny was in Atlantic City, New Jersey, and I don't think he had been in the Olympics or anything, but anyway, they were friends, and John was my swimming coach. So, you know, when you have Tarzan coming over to give you swimming lessons, and my dad made a movie called Follow the Sun about Ben Hogan, the great golfer, and in 1950. So, to the extent that I can say that Ben Hogan gave me golf lessons at age 5, but he did. I mean, they've built a cage in the back of a driving range cage in the back of our home, this giant big estate we were living on, and Dad would be out there with Ben, you know, driving balls to try and mimic his style. And of course, little Petey went out there, and Ben was trying to give me some pointers as well. But you know, it's just Charlie Chaplin was my next door neighbor. Billy Wilder lived down the street. Of course, I was up at Pick Fair all the time, and Fred Astaire lived right around the corner and was at the house often. But Charlie Chaplin ran over my dog, Bill. He used to chase the cars up and down. We lived on a street called Cove Way, and poor Bill got tied up in Charlie's. It was Bill's, you know, fault, but anyway, Charlie killed my dog, and of course I never forgave Charlie Chaplin. I can't watch a Charlie Chaplin movie today.
Yeah, nobody would ever.
Because, you know,
we're almost out of time, and there's something that's always intrigued me, and that is that when we read a biography, when we read something about someone else's life, I always try to find out what is it that I can learn from this person's life. Now, I imagine that's part of the reason you wrote the book. What can we take away from the Glenn Ford life that you think is of value to other people?
Well, you know, John, I would just say this. I can't answer that question. I would love to try. But everybody comes to the book, or I hope comes to the book, with an open mind. They don't know what's in it. And when they read it, I think everybody's going to take something, and I think they're not going to read this book and go halfway through it and say, this is terrible. I mean, not that I'm such a good writer, but everybody I've talked to say it's a compelling work, and it's a page turner to use it. So I don't know what they're going to take away. Maybe they're going to take away what I took away from my life, is that, you know, don't do it this way. Be better, you know, be a better dad. And, but I don't know. I don't know how to answer that question. But I would encourage people to read it. And they don't have to buy it. They can go to the library. We got a wonderful review in Library Journal. So I think it's going to be in libraries. And they should go and just read it. And I'd love to hear from them, you know, tell them.
Well, what I would love, Peter, is for your book to be number one, just as our goal is to be number one worldwide on the Internet. And I would like to share that with all of you as expressed best by Beverly Nadler.
Listen to me. I have something to say about a wonderful way to start your day, a way to stimulate your mind and increase your energy, make you feel so good. And guess what? It's free. Weekdays at 11 a.m. Eastern, hear the Joyce, Barry, and Friends show. You'll find it on the Internet, on Blog Talk Radio. This show is upbeat and fun and very inspirational. It's informative, educational, and very motivational. There's the Coach's Corner, great quotes and news. There are suggestions, perspectives, and advice you can use to enhance your life and improve your health, plus clever, simple ways to increase your wealth. Joyce's perceptions and personality will keep you captivated, and her guests from many walks of life will always keep you fascinated. When Joyce and her friends speak, it's like you're in the conversation. This is part of what makes her show so unique, really a sensation. For Joyce's friends are not only the guests you're listening to, they're everyone who is tuning in. Yes, I do mean you. So refer your friends and family. They'll be so pleased to know. And let's make Joyce, Barry, and friends the number one internet radio show.
Yay! So over to you, John, for your final question. I've got mine, and then we'll wrap it up with Peter.
I think the only question left in my mind for Peter is that it must have been a very difficult thing to do to read those diaries and face up to some of the things that you experienced as a young man, put them all in the proper place in your life, and then to go on with your own life. Was that a difficult task for you?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I've been coming to terms with all of it for a long time. I'm an old guy now, so it's not like it wasn't like yesterday, but it is a slow process. But I think I'm at peace with it all now.
That's great.
And my final question is, any thoughts about writing a book about your famous mother?
I would love to. Let's just hope, Joyce, that books are going to exist in the future. I don't know. The way we're going, they're becoming like hen's teeth, you know. But I would love to. My mother really deserves a book, and I would love to do it, and I can do it. But I love books. I'm not a Kindle guy, although I know everybody's into Kindle now, but I love it to hold a book in my hand, and I would be honored to do my mother's book.
Oh, and I can't wait to have that conversation about that one. Peter, it really was a pleasure, a privilege to have you on the show. I found it so interesting. I want to call you and schedule another one real, real soon, because I could see that between you and I and John, we could go on for many more hours. What would you like to say to wrap up today?
Well, just thank you for having me, and I do appreciate somebody like you is on the air, because like me and like you and me both, I think we as a nation and as a people need to be uplifted, and it's very important that we don't wallow in either self-pity or the negative, and I do appreciate your show and the things you do, because it's exactly where we need to be.
And we really want to have you back very soon. We want to say this about your book, about John for co-hosting us today, about what you stand for, Peter. You are simply the best.
You're simply